It is far. It is gone to win the game.
The Mets are on their way back.
World champions for the 27th time.
Home plate for all things Major League Baseball. This is the Nosebleeds Podcast on WFUV Sports.
Welcome into another week of Nosebleeds WFUV's Major League Baseball podcast. Nick Guzman alongside Jack Warner and Alex Diaz on Nosebleeds for the first time. Very exciting. And you couldn't have picked a better week to be on the show. I think last night, or yesterday, Wednesday in particular, four straight games of Major League Baseball action. And the Mets advanced the National League Championship Series for the first time since 2015. Myself and Jack were there at both games on Tuesday and Wednesday. The Mets beat the Phillies in the series by a score of 3-1. And it was 4-1 last night, Francisco Lindor's grand slam really being the major keynote. But the Mets, for so long, have, it seems like the big hit has eluded them just historically. And this postseason, time after time again, hit after hit, these Mets continue to come through. But first off, Alex, we're going to start with this Mets-Phillies game, but your reaction initially to the Mets advancing to the NLCS.
Yeah, it was super exciting to see. I think this team reminds me of the Phillies team in 2022. They ended the season hot. They won in the wild card series. I thought this team is a, it feels like they're excited to play baseball, and like it's exciting to watch them play baseball. Obviously, yesterday Lindor comes through with the grand slam, but I think you knew it had to be Lindor. He's kind of put this team on his back down the stretch here. And when Lindor wasn't on, it kind of felt like the Mets weren't on. So it's been super exciting to watch them play so far. Their pitching's been really good, and I can't wait to see what they do going forward.
And me and Jack were blessed by being able to go to both games on Tuesday and Wednesday.
Yes,
with
we
our credentials. Tuesday, there was one seat between myself, Jack, and Evan Harkin in the press box, so we were thinking about sitting on each other's laps. But yeah, we ended up just having two people stand outside in front of the press box, which was arguably a better view because you're like in, you can, you're in the crowd. You can feel the energy a lot more than being in the third row of the press box.
And again, we can debate ticket prices and all that kind of stuff about what you would pay to get into one of these games, what you wouldn't pay. I know I've already heard some displeasure with what the prices of the NLCS tickets are going to be
crazy
at Citi Field. But the one thing that I'll say, and I've been fortunate enough to go to playoff games in the MLB before this one. I've been to two Red Sox playoff games, one in 2013 against Detroit in Detroit, and one against Houston in 21 in Boston. And it's not comparable to any other environment that you witness as a baseball fan. The playoffs, where just a base hit with nobody on gets the place to explode. So for us, I think it was funny how it did work out better standing outside the press box for a little bit, because you really got to become fully immersed in like the crowd. Like, they have the windows open in the press box, yes, but like it just didn't sound the same or feel the same when you're standing out and you know, being amongst the crowd at a postseason game. You just feel a pulse that you don't get at any other time in the season, and it's just such a special environment to be a part of.
I mean, I've never seen Citi Field like that, the way it was on Tuesday night and Wednesday night, and I don't think anybody else has either. I think that's probably the best atmosphere probably we've ever had at Citi Field. The Mets clinching something. They've never clinched anything at Citi Field before, but they get it done last night. They're moving on to the NLCS, where they'll face either the Dodgers or the Padres. There's a couple of specific things from this series that I want to hone in on. And I think the first thing is the Mets starting pitching, because on Tuesday night it was Sean Manaea going seven scoreless. And then on Wednesday it was Jose Quintana following up with five innings, one run, but the run was not earned. It scored on that Mark Vientos error. But you even go back to Game two, Severino struggled a little bit towards the end, but the Mets, in a postseason where just traditionally, as time's gone on, so many managers are so eager to hook their starting pitchers or to take their starting pitchers out of the game as soon as they get into trouble, Carlos Mendoza has shown faith in his starting pitchers, and they've rewarded him. This rotation that wasn't really thought of to be that special at the beginning of the year. Some guys have had career years like Sean Manaea, like David Peterson, like Tyler McGill. And the Mets starting pitching, keeping the Phillies' bats down, a very talented lineup, is a bigger reason as any for the Mets being in the position they are.
I mean, they're basically the unsung heroes, in my opinion. Because obviously, this Mets run has been defined by a lot of big offensive highlights, a lot of, you know, pivotal home runs and great offensive highlights. But I think the starting rotation is the unsung hero of this entire run so far, both the wild card and the NLDS, because, you know, you see, like I'm mentioning before, these offensive highlights. Yes, whenever the Mets had to make a comeback, step up in a certain position, they did. But the other thing, not to take anything away from how amazing those moments were, if you notice, the Mets never really had to make any enormous comebacks. They had a six-run eighth inning or whatever it was. I think it was they put up six runs towards the end of the game in game one. Or it was like a three-run inning and a four. I forget exactly how the breakdown was, but they scored six runs at the end of the game in game one of NLDS. They were only down one run. You look at game two, that was a back-and-forth affair, an insane game. Game three, Manaea, he didn't even need to get the run support that he ended up getting, and they still had a fighting chance in that game because he went through the Phillies order three times. And that's the other thing, you know, I heard Howie Rose on the broadcast because they play it in the press box, you know, at different parts of the press box while we're there. And one of the things that he mentioned, I think going into either the sixth or seventh inning was, again, it doesn't matter if the Phillies are cold at the moment or whatever the case may be. That is one of the most talented offensive lineups 1 through 9 in the entire league. And Manaea had to face them a third time. He went through that order almost completely.
Looked like he was going to get knocked out in that sixth inning.
Right.
After the back-to-back walks, and then he strikes out Bryce Harper and gets through a whole nother inning after that.
So you just saw the starting rotation bringing so much pressure off of everyone else. They brought pressure off the bullpen. It never really felt like the bullpen had to come into any situations that were too freakishly high leverage, except for, you know, points of yesterday and Edwin Diaz making things a little interesting when he first enters the game. But you notice that the starting rotation allowed the offense to not have to do anything too crazy if they had to make a comeback in any of the games. And then it also allowed the bullpen to not come in during any high leverage situations besides game two. So, I mean, I really don't know if there was a more important key to this entire success in these first two rounds than the starting pitching.
Yeah, I think it was key for them so far. Watching the Mets, it kind of felt like they always had a chance to win the game, and I think that it was so essential that their starting pitchers were able to give them that comfort, sort of say. I think each one of them is more than capable. The fact that they can have a four-man rotation right now is kind of impressive considering the fact that they were sitting there like game 162 and they're like, who's pitching? Like, who do we have out here that can go throw? So it's been super exciting to watch that. And I think as long as the starting pitching can keep doing what they're doing, I don't know that there's a team that can beat them right now.
And you coming into this series, you know, sticking with the pitching, I think a lot of people would have had the Phillies bullpen as a strength over the Mets bullpen.
Oh my God.
If you're putting them head to head, think about some of the guys that they have in that Phillies bullpen, whether it's Kirkring or Estevez or Ruiz or Jeff Hoffman, guys who had really, really good regular seasons, who in this series, the Phillies bullpen was absolutely atrocious and the Mets feasted on them. But on the Mets bullpen side of things, I think Carlos Mendoza has recognized that he might need to get a little creative of how he's going to get, you know, all 27 outs in a game. And that's why we've seen David Peterson in a relief role, just trying to piece together these outs. But pretty much everybody who he's called on, you know, maybe with the exception of Jose Buto at times and Phil Maton as well, but whether it's Ryan Stanek or Reed Garrett or David Peterson or Edwin Diaz allowing the two walks, but then it almost seems like with Diaz, he needs to walk those two guys just to lock in for the game really to be on the line, which is a sick thing to do to Mets fans. But,
right.
But it seems like that's the way it is sometimes. And the Mets bullpen, though, what has not been seen as a strength all season, kind of, it's been patched together by Mendoza to be able to get all 27 outs, but I think they deserve just as much as credit for the Mets' success right now.
And the other thing that I think has been so cool about the entire pitching situation for the Mets this season is just like how malleable they've been. That you were just talking about Jose Buto. I understand he's gotten knocked around a little bit in the playoffs, but Buto was a guy that was in the starting rotation and had to do what David Peterson did during the regular season. And when he did that, ended up being one of the best bullpen arms for the Mets. You had Kodai Senga, who spent the beginning of the season injured, comes back for one start, shoves against the Braves, gets hurt again, sits out the rest of the season. The Mets, you know, find a way to get to where they need to get to where Kodai is healthy again, rehabs again, which obviously the rehab wasn't as intense as the first one had to be, but obviously, again, he still had to get back into the shape to play again. And what do you know? He gets the nod in game one of the NLDS, and besides one pitch he would like back to Kyle Schwarber, he shoved too. You got David Peterson, who's been, honestly, heading into the All-Star break, post-All-Star break, maybe even a little bit before the All-Star break, through the rest of the season, their best starter in the entire pitching staff, except maybe Sean Manaea, heads into the bullpen and has done nothing but deliver outs every time he's been called upon in the postseason. So that's the other thing that I think, and I don't know who gets the most credit for that. Is it Mendoza pushing all the buttons? Is it just the players themselves for being, you know, able to switch their roles a lot or be able to adjust to change and be able to work on the run like that? Maybe it's a little bit of everything, but just the constantly moving piece that this constantly changing puzzle that has been the entire Mets pitching staff, both starting rotation and bullpen, has been so fascinating to watch this season.
Yeah, for sure. I think the Carlos Mendoza aspect, he has so much experience. Obviously, it's his first year. He's the rookie manager in Queens, but he's had the experience with the Yankees. He's been under so many great managers like Joe Torre. You have Joe Girardi, Aaron Boone now. He has the experience, and I think this team has kind of rallied around him, and I think they've bought into everything that he's convinced them of and talked to them about. And I think he's been an essential part of this, obviously as much as their starting pitching has been. But then if you turn towards the offense, they've always put them in a situation where the bullpen can be comfortable coming in, and you can say, hey, you can give up a few singles here, but we're going to get it right back for you. Or like, we'll have your back the whole time.
And the other thing is she brings up, you know, Mendoza, getting a little deeper on his experience. He's only 44 years old. He's younger than my father.
Yeah.
Like, this is just the beginning for him. You know, I don't want to get too ahead of ourselves, but to have this sort of campaign in his first season as the Mets manager, and he talked last night when we were talking to him in postgame about how much he appreciates the fan base, and he acknowledged, you know, how he said this fan base has been through a lot, and it felt like he's just so connected to the franchise already when it's literally his first season as manager. I get that he's been in New York the whole time, but it's been with the Yankees. Now, I'm sure just by default being in New York, you're aware of what goes on in Mets land too, I'm pretty sure. But either way, this man never was like a piece of this franchise until he becomes the manager and has really just embodied everything about, like, he embodies everything that it means to be a good manager and someone who's just connected with the franchise and just gets what's going on. So, you know, it's already been exceeded expectations to this point to even reach the NLCS, but they have shown no signs of slowing down. They know the ultimate goal is to make and win the World Series. But what a start. You know, who knows what this could turn into for him. Again, at age 44, most of the managers you see are young grandfathers, you know what I mean? Like, it's an older man position.
Buck Showalter,
exactly. You know, so, you know, I've been so impressed by him.
And even when they were 11 games under 500 and, you know, 0-5 and all this stuff early in the season, he never wavered in his belief of this group, which was very impressive. And I think you can talk about the pitching all you want, but something that this Mets team does that is pretty much, it's antithetical to the history of the New York Mets, is getting a big hit whenever you need it. It seems like whatever the spot is, whenever the hit's required, somebody in this lineup is going to step up and get a big hit. It was the Lindor Grand Slam last night. Before that, Pete Alonso home run, Jesse Winker home run. In game two, Mark Vientos with a game-tying home run in the ninth inning.
Game three, Starling Marte. They load the bases two outs right. They load the bases with no
great
outs.
Underrated
two,
moment.
Two outs right away. They're just hoping, they just need run support because you know the Phillies' bats are cold, but you can never count on how long they're going to be cold for. What do you do with two outs? RBI single right up the middle and make it a 4-0 game.
Like, and they just keep doing it again and again and again. And it's pretty. It's everybody. It's not just Lindor. It's Vientos. It's Nimmo. It's Alonso. It's Iglesias in game three had a 2 RBI single. So did Marte. JD Martinez got the rally started in that sixth inning that eventually ended up in the Lindor Grand Slam. But I think this lineup is constructed in a way where it's genuinely scary, I think, for opposing pitchers. I think if you were to ask the Phillies bullpen about what they think about this Mets lineup, I think they'd have a lot of respect for it just based on what they did against that Phillies bullpen. And it happened in the Milwaukee series. This is a Mets team offensively that's clicking on all cylinders, but it really starts with Francisco Lindor.
And the other thing I just want to say before we move to just Lindor on his own, it's a testament to how good your lineup is batting 1 through 9 when your leadoff hitter is hitting a grand slam. Like, and when the bottom of your lineup is loading the bases for your leadoff hitter and your best hitter through the entire playoffs to hit a grand slam, that's just a testament to how well things are working 1 through 9.
And the reports are saying there's going to be some reinforcements coming for the NLCS in the form of Jeff McNeil, who seems like he's going to be on that roster, probably at the expense of Luis Angel Acuña.
Yeah.
But which is unfortunate, but I think you definitely need a left-handed bat in there in Jeff to provide another option. But I think I want to hone in on Francisco Lindor, because this is a guy who early in his Mets tenure, there was a narrative floating around that he was not clutch and that he was kind of just a guy who would do it in the regular season. After last season, where Lindor started slow but then really turned it on in the second half, but the Mets were so far out of contention that, you know, some fans were using that as a talking point to slander him, that he only gets it done when the lights are not shining and it not in big moments. But he has been so huge this season. You talk about, first of all, it's been an MVP caliber campaign. Yes, Shohei Ohtani's going to win it. 50-50 is incredible. But Lindor deserves his colors too. You think about the home run against the Braves to get them to this point, then this grand slam right now to send the Mets into the NLCS, one of the biggest home runs in Mets history. That contract, which so many people have regarded as an overpay, I think you can't call it an overpay now just based on what he's done this season. And he really embodies what it means to be a New York Met. He loves this franchise. He's bought in. And I think there's a reason why Mets fans adore him so much. It's because he's lovable and he is an elite baseball player who is an MVP candidate.
And he's a leader. When the team sucked, he took it on the chin. Like, yeah. he did. He doesn't shy away from any sort of criticism that he's received. He goes right up in media press conferences. There was a weird moment early in his Mets tenure, I believe it was, right after he was out of Cleveland, where I think it was Jason Kipnis was talking some garbage about him, and they asked Francisco about it in a press conference, and he was just very mature about it and took it on the chin. Like, Francisco is he's just a stand-up dude. Like, he's a very stand-up dude. And then, second of all, he has high expectations no matter how the team is doing. And you can tell by the way that he handles success in the games. I know a common talking point that we've been, you know, you and I were chit-chatting about last night at the game, and other people have talked about online, is you watch the home run in Atlanta and you watch the grand slam last night, not a shred of emotion on his face when he's rounding the bases. And a lot of times people were pivoting to that immediately as like being a bad thing. Like, why doesn't he show emotion? And he actually kind of awkwardly addressed it when somebody asked about it last night in the press conference. And he was saying, I'm just taking it all in. He was like, that's just me, you know, living in the moment and taking it all in. But in all honesty, when he hits huge home runs like that and makes huge plays like that, just the competitive nature that I've seen out of him over the course of his career, even as a successful young player in Cleveland, I really think that when he hits those home runs and he has those type of moments, he understands they're significant, but I think he's going to celebrate when he wins a World Series. Like, that's the kind of mindset. It's a very Black Mamba, Kobe-esque mindset that I think he has when he's playing, and that is like, I needed to do this anyway for us to reach the end goal. I'm not going to go screaming around the bases after I hit this iconic grand slam.
Yeah, I think this year he's begun to play a little bit more like the Francisco Lindor that we saw in Cleveland. And I think this postseason so far has been reminiscent of that. When he's kind of, I think he's a bit humble. I think, yeah, he's humble. But I think it's because he knows that once the game's over, okay, we can celebrate. But if you hit a home run sixth inning, you still got three more to go. The game's not over. And I think he's kind of put this team on his back when he's needed to. And even when he hasn't been on the field, he's still been a leader. He's still been there to support them. And I think that's super important for a team like this who is always looking to Lindor to be that, like, spark almost.
Yeah, and I think it's definitely helps as a teammate if Lindor hits that home run and you see him just staying calm, like, yeah, job's not finished, we still have work to do. I think that definitely rubs off on everyone else, too. It just feels so vindicating as someone who has all – I've defended Francisco Lindor for the last 4 years. And finally, everyone's on the same page as me.
No, I mean, trust me, I'm right there with you, dude. I mean, it's been just constant bashing, I feel like. I feel like he's gotten such little respect. And you brought up the Shohei. We were talking about this last night. You brought up the Shohei is the MVP thing. I agree Shohei Ohtani is the MVP because he did the 50-50 thing, and no one else has done the 50-50 thing, and it's cool, and it's swaggy. I get it. It's cool. The problem I always had was when, like, people would roll their eyes at the thought of a MVP conversation for Francisco Lindor. I'm not asking you to give the guy the MVP off the rip. Like, that's not what I want you to do. I think that Shohei Ohtani will rightfully win the MVP, and that's fine. But there should be a mutual respect league-wide for what one player has done for this team. Like, he has put this team on his back at you can look to multiple different points in the season where he's done so. And, yeah, I just thought it was funny that we were chit-chatting about it last night. Just the whole, like, yeah, Shohei's the MVP, but don't scoff at the idea that MVP votes could go to Francisco Lindor.
Bottom line is the New York Mets are heading to the NLCS for the first time since 2015. They clinch at Citi Field for the first time ever. That goes for division titles, for wild card, anything. They've never won anything at Citi Field. The NLCS will start on Sunday, October 13th. It is hard to believe that the Mets are in this position based on where they were, but they are. And I'm so grateful that myself and Jack and Evan, for one of the games, were able to go and take it all in and be in the press conferences and be in the press box for these big moments. So incredibly grateful for that. But for New York City as a whole right now, guys, baseball is booming. The New York Yankees also in the American League Division Series. Last night, Game 3, they take it 3-2 over the Kansas City Royals. It was Clark Schmidt against Seth Lugo in that one. And a low-scoring game for the Yanks. Aaron Judge again goes 0-for-4 in the playoffs. Hasn't quite beat those playoff ghosting allegations yet. I do think he will. I feel like there's no – I mean, right, there's no way he
– It'll come in a big spot like it always does.
It'll come in a big spot like it always does. Luke Weaver with the 5-out save, who's been – just a godsend in that Yankees bullpen. And it was Giancarlo Stanton offensively providing the keynote with that go-ahead home run in the eighth inning. It hasn't necessarily been pretty for the Yanks through the first three games of this series, but Alex, I'll start with you. They have a 2-1 lead, which is about all you can ask for, with Garrett Cole going to the mound tonight.
Yeah, I think for tonight, Cole at least needs to do a little bit better than last time. I got to go to game one at the stadium, which is the best place to be in October, if we're being honest. But I think this team needs to figure out a way to score runs. Every single pitcher who has gone out there, Cole, Rodon, Schmidt, started three games. None of them have been that abysmal that they shouldn't have won all three. Yeah, you're facing good pitching on the other half, on the other side of it. The Royals wouldn't be in the playoffs if they didn't have good pitching, if they weren't a good team. But this lineup 1-9 is not doing what they need to be doing. Honestly, Stanton stepped up, Gleyber stepped up, but there's been a few people who haven't contributed as much as you would have liked to see them contribute. Obviously, Judge in that matter. Wells has been a little bit non-existent as of late. Even going to Verdugo lower in the lineup, there's been the it's been a little controversial there.
Yeah.
But he knows how to perform in the playoffs, and that's why he's still in the lineup. That's why he's out in left field, because he knows what it takes to perform in the playoffs. It'll be interesting to see if they get it done tonight, but I think they need to get it done tonight.
Yeah, I was pleased with what I saw from Clark Schmidt last night, which was good to see, because obviously they ended up making the decision to roll with him instead of Heel, which, you know, there was perfectly fine arguments to make for either one to deploy in that situation. They've both been impressive this season. I was personally a proponent of going Schmidt over Heel, and obviously he reaches kind of a a halt in the fifth inning, and you know, things kind of go downhill from there. But he retires, I think it was 13 of the first 16 batters he faced in the game. Like, it was a very effective start to open up. Honestly, I feel like this always happens. I don't know if I'm just a pessimistic Red Sox fan. I always seem to have more positivity about the Yankees than I feel like the Yankee fans do. I don't know why. Granted, I do agree with you that the pitching across all the first three games, this should have been a sweep. Like, yeah. I agree with you. Like, they pitched more than completely fine enough to win all three of those first games. But I think in any playoff run, what you're going to run into, and I'm not even going to try to jump into the whole Judge playoff disappearance thing, because it's scary. Yeah, for if you're a Yankee fan, it's scary for me. I'm delighted. But all jokes aside, like, Judge is just never a guy you're gonna count out. I think there's going to be a big moment coming from him at some point. People were also saying, oh, my God, he hasn't hit a home run in weeks. And then what does he do? He hits a go-ahead grand slam against the Red Sox in the regular season. So, like, if anyone knows that Judge can come up in a big spot out of nowhere, it's me. But I think last night was a perfect indication of exactly what playoff baseball is about. And it's that there's nine batters in a lineup for a reason. Giancarlo Stanton, the things that were being said about him the final month of the season, that he looks like he forgot how to swing a bat, that it's some of the worst looking at bats that he's ever had as a New York Yankee. For him to step up the way he did last night, he won them that game. This could, yeah, without his performance last night.
And he stole a base.
I mean, how about that? You see this guy hitting ground balls that almost reach the outfield, and he's getting thrown out at first because he's got rocks in his pockets. And all of a sudden, he's stealing bases last night.
Yeah, no one saw it coming.
Exactly. But, no, I think last night was a perfect indication of what playoff baseball is about. And it's whoever is on a roll that night needs to carry the team, and everyone else will follow suit and try to be the best contributors that they can be. But I always pivot back to, again, my Red Sox in 2018. The World Series MVP was not Mookie Betts in 2018. It was not Xander Bogaerts. It was not Rafael Devers. It wasn't Andrew Benintendi. It was Steve Pierce, and he was like 40 years old. Playoffs is just a next man up mentality. And I think last night you saw an experienced baseball player, someone who's already produced for the Yankees in the postseason. Like, I get the Yankees haven't had abundant postseason success in the past few years, but let's not forget, Red Sox pitching cannot pitch to Giancarlo in Fenway Park. We learned this a couple years ago in the wild card. Like, this guy rakes. This guy knows how to hit in the postseason, and I think last night was, again, just an indication of what you're going to encounter in a playoff run. I think if you have the greatest team God's ever assembled, you will still run into a game like last night where they just get out by the skin of their teeth, and it's because one guy stepped up, and that was what Giancarlo did.
And the interesting part is, I feel like the narrative all season was that the Yankees aren't going to be able to be successful if Judge and Soto, it's just Judge and Soto, basically. Offensively, like, that's it. And they're going to go as far as the Yankees carry them. But, you know, Soto did have the sac fly in game three. But Judge has pretty much been non-existent, and the Yankees have still found a way to be up 2-1 in the series. So what if he starts raking? Like, then I feel like you can start to get really optimistic about this team's chances. But I think it's both worrying that he hasn't gotten going yet, but also a little bit reassuring that you've kind of been able to claw yourself two wins here in this division series against a Kansas City team that they do have a really good pitching staff, a good starting pitching staff. But to be up 2-1 in this series where your star hasn't arrived yet, it's definitely feels like a good place to be with Gerrit Cole going tonight. Here's what I want to ask. Can the Yankees get where they want to get if Aaron Judge doesn't show up this postseason? Is it possible for them to make a deep run if Judge continues to struggle like this?
I'll let you go first.
I think on paper, they're a deep enough team when you look at who is on the team. Obviously, you have Stanton. Soto will come around. He gets his walks that he needs to get. He's still a presence in the outfield. Obviously, your infield, Judge Chisholm's first postseason with the Yankees, he's more than capable of showing up. As long as Aaron Judge continues to be a presence, whether it's just having a longer at-bat, whether it's seeing a lot of pitches, or whether it's making big plays in center field, I think this team is more than equipped to be able to make a run. But I think having Judge could push them even further over the edge.
I think Judge being non-existent leaves it entirely up to how the other team is doing. Because I think if Judge remains how he's hitting right now, I think the Yankees have no shot. And the only reason I say that, I could see them making the World Series. I could see them doing that. But Dodgers are clicking 1-9. Padres are clicking 1-9. Mets are clicking 1-9. Maybe not to the extent of the Padres and Dodgers at the moment, but can and have. Tigers and Guardians are cold as ice right now, so I don't know. But
back-to-back shutouts.
That's true. Yeah. The point I'm getting at is I think this Yankees team is talented enough to do anything. Like, this was my – I thought this team was winning a World Series after April 31st. Like, I really, like – I didn't think that there was any other team you could think of to win a World Series. But now just seeing how hot some of the teams in the National League are and just the story – and I know this sounds kind of corny, but the stories behind a couple teams. Because I feel like you have teams in this playoff in these playoffs right now. Some of them have the talent argument and or the talent story, and some of them have the story argument where it's the Mets are here because they have a great story. The Tigers are here because they have an even better story. And it's like you got the story teams who are gritty and will work it out, and then you got just the raw skill teams that like the Padres and Dodgers who are going to game five that kind of just throw a wrench into things. I think it's going to be entirely up to what the other teams bring if Judge is not showing up, and that's why you better hope that Judge shows up if you're a Yankee fan.
I think I 100% agree with that. I mean, I think they're going to win this series regardless, but once you get into the ALCS and you're facing a Tigers team maybe that has some weird voodoo magic going on where it seems like everything's going their way pitching-wise, and they're getting the clutch hits despite, you know, watching these Tigers playoff games and looking at up and down their lineup, you're like, this team should not be where they are right now, but they are because there's some kind of, there's something happening. It's a real thing in the postseason. It's just about who gets hot. You know, Cleveland could possibly come back and win that series. Back-to-back shutouts is demoralizing after winning game one. So we'll see. But I think the path to the World Series has never been clear for this Yankees team in terms of, there's no other juggernaut here in the American League waiting to knock them out, like the 2018 Red Sox.
Right.
Or that Houston Astros team in 2019. That's right. Really good. There's none of that looming. So it feels like you have to make the World Series. You have to win the World Series this year just based on, number one, the talent that you have, and then also your route to get there probably has never been easier.
Yeah, I mean, the way that it's set right now, here's the thing. It's one of those seasons where it looks like their path is clear as day. It's clear cut. That's also what makes it more stressful, though, is it, you start to encounter this reality of if they don't do it this year, will they ever? Because I can tell you right now, this Yankees team could look way different next season. And some of it is riding, I think, on how this postseason goes. Obviously, do I think the whole Juan Soto sweepstakes is going to be a highest bidder type situation? Who knows? That's a story for another time. But there's pieces of this There's pieces of this Yankees team that could look completely different next season. Granted, a lot of your core guys are here for the next few years, next several years. But this could be a completely different team next year. And when you have such a clear-cut route to a World Series where you are such a favorite, it really does make – it adds all the pressure because it makes it a – if it doesn't happen this year, when is it going to happen? We've seen it in other sports before. The President's Cup winning Bruins a couple years ago, getting bounced in the first round by the Panthers. You could even, staying with hockey, you could even talk about the Rangers last year winning the President's Trophy and fizzling out in the Eastern Conference Final. Like, we've seen this before where it does always, there's a pressure that comes along with being the surefire favorite, and it's that if you can't do it with this team, who are you going to do it with?
Yeah, I think once the Astros lost, I think a lot of Yankees fans wrote it in as the Yankees were winning the World Series, right? Because the Astros weren't there. They weren't going to face them. And then you go to game two and you bring the Royals to Yankee Stadium and you lose at Yankee Stadium. And that's a bit, I think, demoralizing for fans as well as probably players on the team. I think the fans have put so much into it that that's where the pressure really is mounting from. And obviously, like you said, there's going to be so many changes next year. Obviously, the bullpen is always different every year because that seems to be the Yankees' motto. The team next year 100% depends on what happens now and if the Yankees can pull it out.
And with all this talk about the Yankees, you know, needing to win the World Series, reality is they're one win away from the ALCS, and they could be there after tonight with your ace on the mound. It wasn't great in game one, but do you feel like is due for a bounce back start against Michael Wacha? That'll be tonight at 8:08 p.m.
Should be a really good game.
If the Yankees win, they will advance the American League Championship Series to face either Cleveland or Detroit. But the other fun news, I think we're going to hop back to the National League for probably the most drama-filled series of them all.
Ugh.
These teams hate each other. It's so toxic, but it's awesome.
It makes for a great viewership experience.
The Los Angeles Dodgers and the San Diego Padres are tied at 2 games apiece after the Dodgers' 8-0 win in a do-or-die game 4 for them last night in San Diego. A bullpen game for these Dodgers and 8 different pitchers combined for a shutout.
Unreal.
So you talk about how damaged this Dodgers rotation has been. I mean, the names that are on the shelf, you can go on and on and on. But to put together in a do-or-die game a bullpen performance like that is pretty legendary. When it seemed like all the momentum was going the Padres' way, whether it's the Manny Machado throwing the ball against the dugout thing where he threw it hard enough to get them mad, but not hard enough that it looks like they're soft. He found the sweet spot.
Yeah.
Where he threw it hard enough against the railing to make it a thing, but soft enough that like everyone's like, you can't get mad at that.
Yeah.
He hit the middle right there.
Two things can be true at once.
He knew what he was doing, if we're being honest.
Machado knew what he was doing, and Dave Roberts' response was kind of soft.
It was very soft.
It was really soft. I didn't like it at all. And it hurts me to say that, being, you know, he's a special piece to that 04 Red Sox team. I never want to slander Dave Roberts, but that was, I did not like it.
And the whole article that Ken Rosenthal wrote, now the Padres refused to do in-game interviews with Ken Rosenthal after that.
Really?
Yes, that came out, that they refused to do it after that story. So there's so much drama in this series, but it kind of felt like the momentum was all with the Padres after the Dodgers, I think, being objectively a little bit soft,
right,
with that whole incident and just how amped up the Padres were. But for them to come back and put up an 8 spot last night, setting up a winner-take-all game 5 where Dave Roberts has not committed to a starting pitcher yet.
Nope.
It based on the schedule, it could be Yamamoto, could be Flaherty too, or it could be a mix of both, or whoever you need in winner-take-all game 5. But I think going into this NLDS series, I think a lot of people had it circled as a good one, just based on the Dodgers being the best team in baseball, the Padres being so hot really since the month of June and just never letting up. And it's really lived up to it. There's been drama, there's been intrigue, and now you get a winner-take-all game 5 on Friday night. But Jack, what have you made of this series so far?
I mean, I think the product on the field has been fantastic, but again, I think the drama has just made it way more fun. The other thing was Dodger fans, who are already known as the epitome of class, throwing things onto the field.
I didn't even mention that. There's been so much stuff.
Throwing stuff on the field, throwing baseballs near Jerks and Profar, which I understand he has a bit of history with, some beef with the Dodgers, and I'm sure Dodger fans don't take too kindly to Jerks and Profar, but can I just say, throwing hard objects anywhere near, actually, they don't even have to be hard objects, throwing things near professional athletes on their playing surface is honestly deplorable and disgusting, but especially baseballs that I get did not hit him, but say a baseball hits him in the head, which is always a possibility, that would be just such a bad thing to happen. I've been hit in the head with a baseball before. It's not fun. I don't think you have to be hit in the head with one to know it's not fun. So I just wanted to quickly just throw that out there, that like, that was completely,
you can't throw
disgusting
stuff at players.
And I also thought the broadcast did a poor job of like condemning the stuff that was going on in the game. At least what I was listening to made it sound like it was just one or two people. Like it was not. It was several people. Because then they started throwing stuff at Tatis. Did you see Tatis dancing? Tatis dancing in right field was the funniest thing. And I don't want to come off sounding anti-Dodgers. Like I'm not. It's just. I was very against the way that those Dodger fans conducted themselves. If that happened in any other park, I'd say the same thing. But back to the actual baseball aspect of this, I mean, oh my God, it's been an amazing series back and forth. You've seen some good pitching duels, but the thing I've been most, you know, intrigued by is the, I guess you could say the revitalizing of Mookie Betts, who had a very cold start.
And that was a talking point, similar to Judge. And then
playoff disappearance.
And then he broke out in the last 2 years.
And you saw a lot of Padres fans on Twitter putting side-by-sides of Fernando Tatis' playoff batting statistics to Mookie's as like, you know, to make fun of him. But back-to-back games with leadoff homers to kind of set the tone to start the game. Almost 3 games in a row with a leadoff homer, but yeah. Profar robbed him in game two. So... I think watching Mookie, you know, shine has been pretty amazing. You know, just some of the highlight moments you got. Shohei's home run in game one was unbelievable. But above all, above everything else, I don't think that there has been a more exciting postseason hitter to watch so far than Fernando Tatis Jr. I mean, the guy just lives for those kind of moments, lives for high leverage games, and just hits home. He really does put the team on his back and provides such a spark for that bench, and he does it night in and night out. Those two home runs in game two. My apologies. It's been a long week. Those two home runs in game two were just absolutely, both of them, destroyed, filthy, pissed on, whatever you want to say. I feel like I'm just talking in circles. This series has been the coolest one of the four.
Yeah, I agree. Anytime a series goes to game five, it's exciting as long as it's not my team. That's a little too stressful.
Exactly.
That's a little too stressful. I'll watch from afar. But I think Tatis, I think you kind of expected he was going to show up in the postseason. He's a guy who thrives off of moments like that. Mookie Betts, you knew he was going to come around eventually. He's never going to shy away from that moment, and he's always going to be contributing to something, even if he's not hitting home runs or hitting as great as he might be every day. I think this series has kind of brought in, I think, both teams closer to themselves. Like, the Padres have kind of banded together after the incident in L.A. in Game 2, which was interesting to see. And then they come into San Diego in Game 3 and kind of blow away the Dodgers. I think it's been really exciting to watch these teams be playing against each other. I got a little worried coming in, wondering if the series was going to be a little bit boring because they played each other so many times during the regular season, but it's been the opposite of that, and it's been super exciting to watch.
And there's always so much controversy. I think that the momentum was definitely with the Padres before Game 4 when you think about, number one, the fans throwing stuff at the Padres in Game 2, and then the Dodgers lose that game. Then there's the whole Manny Machado thing, and then they lose Game 3. It kind of felt like it was lining up for a Padres clincher in Game 4. There was going to be a bullpen game for the Dodgers because of their lack of reliable starting pitching right now. And you had Dylan Cease, one of your best starters all year for the Padres, going, and he doesn't last 2 innings.
Right.
So it just, in playoff baseball, you never know.
And no Musgrove hurts them.
No Musgrove hurts. If the Mets were to face the Padres in the NLCS, thank God there's no Joe Musgrove.
No, I completely agree. No, thank God there's no shiny ears.
Oh, my goodness. But I think a lot of credit has to go to the Dodgers and their bullpen for being able to piece together a do-or-die game like that. 8 pitchers combining for a shutout is not something you see every day. But I think there is something to be said for a playoff bullpen game when all your arms are reliable. It's tough to see that many different pitchers because you feel like you get a read on a guy after one at-bat. Maybe you ground out, but you feel like you've got it. The next at-bat, you're facing a totally different guy.
8 pitchers is nuts, too. Like, you never are seeing – you couldn't go 3 batters without seeing the same, you know – if they get a couple hits, fine. But, like, you basically never saw the same pitcher twice, like, no matter what.
And going into this Game 5, it's going to be Yu Darvish on the mound for the Padres. And we'll see for the Dodgers who they're going to throw out. There was some concern. There were some reports that maybe Yamamoto was tipping his pitches in Game 1. But we'll see who Dave Roberts wants to go with, whether it's Yamamoto or Flaherty, maybe a combination of both. But it's winner take all at Dodger Stadium, and I feel like we have to take a pick of who's going to win that game, even though I have literally no idea.
I don't either. Because
I see a world where the Padres come out and just rake and kind of blow the doors off the game, and it's embarrassing for the Dodgers. But also, you know, you can see the Dodgers getting you dark. There's so much firepower in both lineups that it's very hard to make a pick. I think I'm gonna pick the Dodgers. I think San Diego had their chance in Game 4 to close this thing out at home with the momentum from everything that's gone on in this series, and they laid an egg pretty much. So I think the Dodgers are going to capitalize on that and win Game 5. Don't quote me on that, though. I don't know.
Make sure you guys quote Nick Guzman on that. Oh my God. This is a tough one. I'm going to say, so part of me wants to say the Dodgers are going to win because I feel like I've learned time and time again to stop trusting the Padres. I feel like every year, I say they're good enough to win the World Series.
But this year feels different.
And they never do. Like, that's the thing. Like, I feel like every year I'm like, this team could finally, like, win them the World Series for the first time in forever. I feel like they could finally get done this year, and it feels like they never do. I'm going to go Padres winning this. And it's for one reason. It really is for one reason. It's for a couple reasons. First of all, I think I've just become such a Fernando Tatis Jr. truther and stan throughout the course of his playoffs. I really think his defining moment is coming tonight. Or not tonight, whenever the game is played. Or it's coming some point in this playoffs. But second of all, I'm going to be honest, I have to stand on business. Because I said earlier in the season, to be a little jerk, I said this team is paying that billion-dollar payroll and doing their contract deferrals, and guess what? They're not going to win the World Series. So you know what? I'm going to stand on business. I'm going to say the Padres win tonight. It wouldn't be the first time that the Dodgers have lost an NLDS Game 5 in L.A. Because Howie Kendrick, a couple years ago in 2019, hitting a grand slam in the 11th inning and just making everyone file for the exits.
Or the 2015 Mets, Game 5 at Dodger Stadium.
Exactly. So that's true. You know what? That's going to be the rationale, because NLDS Game 5s at Dodger Stadium have not been kind to the Dodgers. That's my rationale.
I'm also going to take the Padres. I think if the Dodgers go bullpen game again, which there have been a little bit of talk about, the Dodgers might have the edge. But if Yamamoto goes back out there, Flaherty goes back out there, I think the Padres will have the edge then. I also like Petco Park better than Dodger Stadium. So part of my Padres bias. But yeah, I think the Padres can get it done tomorrow night.
Kurt, I'm IFB and you. Wait, that's my cough button. Sorry. Kurt, IFB me. Totally butchered that. Kurt says Dodgers because he wants the Mets to play the Dodgers more than he wants them to play the Padres.
I don't really have a preference as a Mets fan. I think let them kill each other in Game 5. And we'll take who survives.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a fair take. I mean, look, we both talked about it last night. I don't think there's, a preferable option coming out of the series.
The Dodgers' lack of starting pitching, I feel like we could feast on it.
It's a bit enticing.
I think we could feast
on it. It's a little bit enticing.
Because how many bullpen games can you have in these 7-game series? You're gonna get tired eventually.
Yeah, no, I agree.
But
Padres in five.
I'm going to go Dodgers in five, although I wouldn't be mad if the Padres won, just because it would be really funny if the Dodgers did all the stuff that they did in the offseason just to crash and fail when it mattered most. But there's one final series we have to get to, and that also could be decided tonight, very soon actually, 6:08 p.m.
Oh, boy.
Game 4 set for first pitch between Cleveland and Detroit. The Tigers with a 2-1 lead in the series over the Guardians. This is a Detroit team that beat the Astros in the wild card series and then laid an egg in Game 1 against the Guardians 7-0. How do you respond to that after losing game one, getting shut out? By shutting out Cleveland twice in a row. Two straight shutouts, 3-0, both scores over the Cleveland Guardians. And you think about that, Kerry Carpenter's home run in game two.
Kerry Bonds.
An epic moment off of Emmanuel Clase. But I think if you're a Cleveland fan, your rationale after game two was like, okay, that was Scooble's start. We were never going to win that anyway. But then you get shut out in game three as well. And now you're worried that your offense has just disappeared at the absolute wrong time. It's a Cleveland team that kind of has been, I think in a similar fashion to the Phillies, just kind of been coasting a little bit down the stretch here the last couple months, where it's been seemingly, there's a couple times where that division got close, but they never really relinquished first place.
Right.
And then the lead grew again. But
career year out of J-Ram, but besides.
Career year out of J-Ram, the best closer in baseball in Emmanuel Clase.
Blowing it to Kerry Carpenter.
That is not a good sign. And this is a Tigers team where if you look up and down this lineup, it's hard to believe that they're here. If you just look at like the regular season OPSs of the guys that are getting starts in the playoffs, it's hard to believe that they're in this spot. But with Tarik Skubal with a bullpen that has been lights out pretty much in this postseason, I mean, think about what they did yesterday against this Cleveland team. So impressive to get back-to-back postseason shutouts. And now they have a chance to advance to the ALCS, a spot where no one thought they would be, even in the middle of September. What a run from the Tigers, and I think I want them to win. Do you want them to win, Jack?
I want the Tigers to be the American League representative in the World Series. Sorry. I mean, actually, I shouldn't be saying sorry. You're looking at my hat. I already know. But
there's just some kind of magic around this team right now where you felt like, maybe is Cleveland going to steamroll them after they win game one, but then the Tigers come back with two straight shutouts. It's so impressive.
Listen, I used to live out there. I used to live out in Detroit, spent a lot of time at Comerica Park, and what I can tell you is what this team has meant to the city of Detroit has been nothing short of amazing, especially what the Lions last year meant to Detroit, making the NFC title game. Tigers this year are just the epitome of grit. They finished the season. I believe they went 30-11 to finish the season, winning 30 of their last 41 games to get themselves a spot in the playoffs. What it's meant to the city of Detroit, especially because the Tigers were repeat offenders in the playoffs in the early 2010s. Those Jim Leland-managed Tigers teams were always so competitive but can never get the job done. They make the World Series in 2012, and they get swept by the Giants and lose in the World Series. They make the ALCS in 2013. The Red Sox knock them out. The Red Sox win the World Series. They make it to the playoffs in 2014.
The Orioles beat them in the DS.
Orioles knocked them out in the DS. So then you get a 10-year playoff drought, and you're starting to see Detroit be a baseball city again. Some of the worst baseball teams ever between, like, over the course of that playoff drought. I believe it was the 2019 Tigers, one of those Tigers teams, like, at the end of the 2010s into the 2020s, was on that list that, like, the White Sox just topped. Like, I think they were the second or third worst team by record in the history of baseball. So when you look at the drought that's been over the last 10 years and how empty Comerica Park has looked at times throughout that time, and now getting to see that stadium sold out again as a playoff atmosphere. I got to go to an ALCS game in Detroit when I lived there. It was absolutely unreal, the environment. This team is special, man. And like you mentioned, no superstars. I mean, Riley Green was a all-star. You could say that, I guess, no superstars in the batting order. Tarik Skubal's a superstar. Yeah. But Riley Green was an all-star, but he's a very, very, very good baseball player. I wouldn't call him an elite player, but he's a very good player and an all-star. But this team has just shown so much. Kerry Carpenter, Spencer Torkelson, who got sent down in the middle of the season and brought back up again. I'm really hoping that they can end it in their own stadium and move on to the ALCS and take on whoever comes out of this Yankees Royals series.
Yeah, I agree. I think the Tigers have been a really exciting team to watch. I love to watch a team where you can sit down and say 1-9, everybody has like just as much as a chance to get something done. It's hard for me to root for the Tigers just because AJ Hinch is their manager.
Yeah.
And I'd love to not get burned by AJ Hinch again, because the Yankees have done it in the postseasons many a time lately. But I think it's so exciting for a city to almost be like rejuvenated by a team like this, and it's been exciting to watch. I think they're going to get it done against Cleveland today, and hopefully we'll be looking to face the Yankees on next Monday.
And for Cleveland, I feel like this would be nothing short of disastrous if you
lose
this series.
This feels like a very Cleveland thing to do.
It does feel like a very Cleveland thing to do. But I think it is a fair point when you talk about a team like them and the Phillies, where it's like they've pretty much known they're going to win this division, and they've known that pretty much since, I don't know, June? Like, realistic, like
their work has been more than cut out for them.
Their work, yeah. But when you think about, you know, this Tigers team that's been fighting and clawing for pretty much everything just to get into the playoffs, to get into the wild card, then to beat the Astros, and now to be in this spot one game away from the ALCS, I think it's so worrying if you're a Cleveland fan that your offense has gone ice cold in the most crucial part of the season, losing game two and losing game three. And I think my money's probably on Detroit to close things out in game four. Is it going to be a bullpen game again, or do they have it's BB going for Cleveland.
I remember seeing Skubal was available for game five was what they said, if there needed to be a game five.
So you're still feeling pretty good about that, even if it has to go back to Cleveland. But you want to get it done now.
You want
to
win it. You want to play the least amount of
finish,
games possible.
And finish things off. But it's just so impressive that they're here.
It still says Detroit's undecided.
Yeah, so it'll probably be whoever. And they're going to piece it together like they did in game three. It's just so impressive for them to be here when you look at just their lineup, and there's not any stars, like, at all. And for them to be all banded together and contributing, it's a team that's very easy to root for. And I think a lot of times that there's teams that kind of make a late push towards the playoffs and it doesn't really end up being anything. But for the Tigers, it's a magical run, and they're one win away from the ALCS. But I think that'll just about...
Mets-Tigers World Series
Mets-Tigers World Series would feed families. But I think that'll just about wrap up this week's episode of Nosebleeds. What an exciting time to be a New York baseball fan, with both teams still in it. The Yanks one win away from the NLCS, the ALCS, the Mets already in the NLCS. But for Nick Guzman, Jack Warner, and Alex Diaz, Kurt Sippel helping us out behind the glass, this episode of Nosebleeds has been a production of WFUV Sports.